Good morning, and welcome to the Morning Phillips series, co-sponsored by the Bush Foundation and the NewMed Group, hosted here at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Phillips series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It's an opportunity to have conversations with good people doing good things creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch. Usually, it has two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. Today, we have three chairs, a table, and this community. We're pleased to have the three people in front of us. The NewMed Group would like to extend a special thank you to Haggerty Music Works for sound, South Dakota Public Broadcasting for recording, Jackalope for helping organize the sound, the members of the Garage and co-working space for letting us use your office, the Bush Foundation, and everyone here. For further information, please go to Facebook or our website. We're going to be tweeting at hashtag Morning Phillip. We've got a few other pages. 1 second. Today, our guests are Tony, Richard, and Jack. Asking questions is retired Judge Jack Delaney, with 33 years in military service, city attorney in Spearfish, 7th Circuit Court judge for 9.5 years, trial lawyer for 25 years, and 7-time marathon runner. Jack has experienced and seen many world, national, and local events, and today we are honored to have him with us. Richard served as city finance officer for Rapid City from 1990 to 1995, working for Mayors Carlisle and McLaughlin. As finance officer, he was active participant in the concept, creation, planning, and bonding, which resulted in the original Vision Fund, known as 2012. He has also worked as executive budget analyst for the state of South Dakota under Governor Bill Janklow, as vice president for finance and administration at Dakota Wesleyan University, and as vice president for business and finance at Drake. From 1993 to 1998, he served as South Dakota Investment Council, which oversees the $10 billion South Dakota Public Employees Retirement Fund. He has a master's in public administration from Harvard University. Tony is proprietor and operator of Murphy's Pub and Grill, the Blind Lion Speakeasy, and is currently underway on his latest project, Coal. Tony strives to create concepts that are cutting edge of the global food and beverage scene with the goal of making Rapid City a premier dining destination. Tony was born and raised in Rapid City, but spent a decade in Boston, Massachusetts, before and attending Northeastern University, graduating with a degree in business administration. Tony returned to Rapid City in 2011 in order to take his skills and experiences attained along his journey to make the Black Hills everything it can be. I want to say another thanks to these three people, as well as members of the Garage, for joining us for dinner last night and a couple-hour conversation about Rapid City and the future of Rapid City. Just the amount of time these guys have given, just really appreciate it. So, the questions today were published on Tuesday and provided to Tony and Richard. There are many questions for a 50-minute session, but if both keep answers to about 2 minutes, and Jack doesn't ask too many follow-up questions, we'll get through all of them. Jack is the only one that's going to ask follow-up questions, and at the end of the conversation, if there is time, Tony and Richard will have 3 minutes each to share more about their vision. Now, with all that, please welcome Jack, Richard, and Tony.
Good morning, folks. And we're pleased to present this. And it's not in the typical debate forum where the parties are addressing or poking at each other. This is a series of questions that were designed just from discussions that we thought public answering and views that would reflect the visions and perceptions of both sides as to these issues might be helpful in our community deciding this question in the next week. So to that end, we're going to ask each of them to answer these questions. We're going to start with Tony addressing what he thinks or the proponents think are five of the most important characteristics of an optimal civic center facility. And with that, I'll give you the mic.
Great, thank you. Good morning, everyone. So the first three answers that I have come directly from Craig Baltzer, our new GM. And the reason why I wanted to publish his thoughts is that he's going to be the one leading the initiative for the future. We actually spent a lot of time recruiting Craig, and he's been with three other arenas of similar size at a similar life cycle, meaning that they were just built, and he actually helped them get off their feet. So he goes in this order. Number one, it's about community. For example, if you look at the sign that's outside the YMCA, it's where the community comes together. There aren't too many spots like that in our community, and this is one. Second is economic impact. And that's probably one of the biggest ones that are really the driver behind these. People coming to our shops, eating in my restaurants, sleeping in our hotel rooms. The third is really to help the bottom line, to make sure that you've got a profitable civic center that's productive. The other two, and this is probably the more recent one, is the versatility of the arena. You want to make sure that it's not a one-trick pony, that it can't do just concerts, that it can't do just a rodeo. You want to make sure that it can host functions, basketball games, indoor track, have an expo football game where the Broncos and the Vikings face off, because that would be pretty amazing. And lastly, something that's built for 2050. If you could have ever imagined what Rapid City would have looked like in 1972, I don't think many people would have been able to predict that. So we can't build an arena for today. We have to build it for the future, because we don't know what Rapid's going to look like in 40 years, but I have a pretty rosy outlook for it.
Thank you. Richard?
I've not asked Craig that specific question, but it would be very difficult to disagree, particularly with his initial points. I think, our civic center needs to be a vibrant, active center in this community that is open to all socioeconomic and available, accessible to all socioeconomic classes, and that hosts a wide variety of activities that appeal to everyone, from the symphony, which unfortunately can no longer afford to perform there, to monster truck races or whatever, and dirt bike racing. It needs to be available across the community for a whole wide variety. It needs to be a center. It needs to be a magnet for conventions. After all, one of its key roles is to bring money into this community, which is being spent by people from outside this community, and continue to play that role. It should be a place that we, as Rapid Cityans, are proud of. That we are proud of taking guests there, that we are proud to go there ourselves, and I recognize that's, of course that's vague in its way, and that's in the mind of the beholder. I think it should also, it needs to be clean, fresh, well-managed, financially sound, and whether or not any of those characteristics necessarily need the additional footprint that's being proposed in this proposal, I'm not convinced of that.
Okay. Both people address fiscally sound. We have a question more to that point later on, so I'm not going to address that at this time. There is a question that how much use is necessary to justify the respective visions, the size, the various arenas available, and you might, if you choose, break it down into meeting facilities, athletic facilities, or rodeo arenas and that type of thing. We have the band shell and other things. So how do you define or envision the level of use that is necessary to warrant building the structures, if you can?
Obviously, whatever facility we have, whether it's, today, as it stands, which is not what we'll have in a few years, or whether it is significantly expanded or only modestly so, we want it to be maximally use. Now, you know, I can't, you know, I'm Craig Balzer, our GM, is I think the one to, you know, to direct that question to. Most of the time throughout the year, we have sufficient show for or sufficient space for most events. Not all the time. And it's, the question is, you know, building for peak periods and so forth. The Civic Center obviously hosts concerts and athletic events. It hosts meetings and trade shows. And, you know, the fact that some of the events there, say the stock show or the LNI, have a portion of their activities off campus, I don't think is a negative in this community. The fact that the stock show also, you know, has events out at the fairgrounds, I think is a positive. The fact that the LNI can include events in some of the high school gyms around the city of Rapid City, I think is a positive. I am concerned about the theater. That we have a gorgeous theater there, but because of the costs of renting the Civic Center, there are fewer and fewer civic nonprofit organizations. I mentioned the symphony earlier. The Nutcracker, done every other year, is another, which can afford to can afford to rent that in order to do their shows there. You know, and in terms of the ice arena, when that was built, we had a contract with the Rapid City Rush, a long-term contract, knowing that they would be in there and working there, skating there, playing there, working, I guess. With one of the proposals, one of the suggestions from the consultants is that if we build this much larger arena as proposed, is that Rapid City, to meet the revenue that's required to generate there, they suggest we add two more pro sports teams in addition to the Rush. Well, I'm afraid there's a maximum capacity we have in this community for pro sports teams at some point, and I would hate to put the Rush at risk.
Yeah, I'm going to, and we have a question that addresses that tangentially a little bit later in terms of context to establish that, and we might go a little further into that. Sure. At that time. Tony.
So what I'd love to talk about is how our current Civic Center isn't attracting as much as it can, and why that's a problem. The Civic Center is a huge driver of sales tax. I actually had a discussion with a gal last night, and she was like, I don't get it. The Civic Center, you know, it doesn't make a huge amount of money. Why are we doing this? We're doing this because it drives economic impact in the community. And let's talk about why that's important. For example, the pools that we do, they're great. They're great quality of life products, but they take about $685,000 a year to stay afloat. No pun intended. Things like the Doll take $231,000 a year to be supported. So we really need a strong Civic Center to make all these things happen. Let's talk about why it's broken. We recently lost a show to Brookings. I don't know if anybody's been to Brookings, but last time I checked, it's still quite a bit smaller than us. And we're losing these shows because we're not relevant anymore. We're not on the routing anymore. People just keep passing us by. And great acts used to come here. Elvis opened the place. Def Leppard in his heyday. Guns N' Roses in the same year when they sold 5 million records. So it can be used so much more. I was at a Central debate, and I feel bad for these kids because they don't have the emotional connection that I had growing up with the Civic Center. They didn't get to beg their mom to go to a Thrillers game, and when she said no, you'd go try to work dad in that angle. They didn't get a chance like I did with my band. I was an aspiring rock star back in eighth grade, and that didn't work out, as you can see. But we waited for 2 hours outside of the Bush concert because we wanted to be the first ones in the door. And I got to tell you, that was probably, I can recall every minute of that night like it was yesterday. You know, just being right up against the stage, getting to crowd surf, pulling out my lighter and learning how to, you know, sing a cappella to Glycerine. I mean, these moments these kids don't have because we are not doing what we need to do to make this arena marketable. So that's what we need to talk about, is that if we fix this, we can do more. And what kind of things can we do? Well, the stock show, the bloodline of our community, $20 million a year in economic impact, it is bursting at the seams. There's 158 vendors on the waiting list to get in, up from 150 the year prior. Anybody who's been to the stock show or knows about events, I see Alicia here, she could probably expand. The kids can't do a lot of the activities that they really can do to compete on a national scale. So we have events right now that we could use more and do more. And things like the Lakota Nations Invitational. I don't think it's anybody's goal to have everybody spread out. And they already are doing that. They've had to book two other venues just because their event's grown so much. And they really want to do a rodeo. So what I'd like to everyone to think about is what more we can do. For example, what Craig's looking at booking. An RV show that wants to take up the entire space three times a year. Think about what economic impact that would be. Or the huge Caterpillar show up in Fargo, North Dakota. There is so much we can do if we have more space and more event days.
Parking is an issue near and dear to the hearts of most of the community, both paid and unpaid, and downtown and out in the corners of the city. And parking is an issue with the Civic Center. And the question should probably be addressed rather than a specific number of parking spaces, perhaps maybe a percentage of the seating available, because sure, the size is somewhat uncertain depending on how you look at it. And the parking essential to a 8 or 10,000 seating or a 12,000 or 6,000, the number of sites needed are obviously different. And so in that respect, I'm going to turn that question to Richard and let him answer it in the first part. Quantity of on-site. I'm not talking about walking from Main Street. I'm talking about quite, you know, adjacent to, on-site of the Civic Center. Richard?
You know, it's a great question, Jack, and I think if you asked the man on the street, the answer would be we don't have enough and we need more, because, you know, I can't park close enough that I can walk in before I freeze to death, you know. I would agree that as and when we expand, you know, clearly we need to expand our parking too. The challenge that we have is we're landlocked. Over the past 20 years, the Civic Center Board has not been purchasing adjacent property, say north of North Street, to make available perhaps surface parking. The proposal to add possibly a 500 or 600 car garage adjacent to the consultants recommended 2,500 seats or 2,500 spaces does not really solve it. It creates the most expensive kind of parking at the cost of $20,000 to $22,000 construction per parking spot. But more importantly, it will only be used during Civic Center events and during large Civic Center events. So it doesn't address any of the other parking issues that we have in Rapid City. I don't know. Maybe we need a parking garage down. Maybe we need to add three levels to the Main Street parking down by the garage, down by the square, and then have a monorail that runs across, and have a have a real vision for this.
Disney World in Rapid City.
There we go.
Okay. Well, the parking is an issue, Tony.
Sure. Yeah, I think everybody would agree that we could do more, and we do need to do more, but there isn't a magic wand to fix this. It's really a multi-part strategy. Let me kind of take it through my vision, and I'm going to say this is just my vision because I'm not the one who makes these decisions, but I think that this is something that would work. Number one, Craig Baltzer has made the point for the handful of events every year that we have max capacity, for example, the stock show, we need to provide more temporary parking. So, for example, we'll find parking lots, make sure we set up shuttles so that people can actually get to and from the events in that way, because there's only a handful of times that we need that. So per Richard's point, it doesn't make sense to build multiple parking garages at a huge expense when they're only going to be used probably 4 or 5 times a year, or if Eric Clapton comes to town. The other fix, and this is actually something that came up during a recent debate, is paid parking. In my opinion, paid parking is actually part of the solution, and let me tell you why. If you have paid parking in the garage, let's talk about what happens. The code states that you should factor 2.7 people per car. Now, when you don't charge for parking, do you think anybody thinks about that? They don't. There's no incentive, so everybody takes their own cars. Also, those with able bodies that can park in one of the 6,000 spots that are within a 6-minute walk, they have no incentive to do that. But when you start charging for parking, then me, if I don't mind walking 6 minutes from the square, which I think Dan accurately pointed out is just more of a perception issue, we can do that because now we have an incentive. So there's no one fix. I don't think it's ever going to be perfect. But we have to realize that there's multiple things that we can do, and we're already on track to do that.
And the question of paid can be addressed. Those from outside this area assume parking is paid, that you pay for it. However, our local and nicely rural tradition is, why should we have to pay for parking? And it meets an inherent objection from many of us. And there's some trade-offs that will have to be addressed, and I don't have a paid, unpaid.
I mean, we're probably all in the same spot, which is paid parking is justified and it'll go over like a lead balloon.
It's just like the fair, though.
Is there an impression that it might cut attendance? And then the question is, do the revenues you get from the parking offset the loss in attendance? And if your attendance goes down at your routine attractions, rush, sure, or major events, is that an impact?
And it's a great question. And the thing is that if you look at every other arena in our region, they actually charge for parking. We're probably one of the last ones to do that. We actually spend a substantial amount of money every single event to make sure that we can shuttle people back and forth as we do, to make sure that we can take care of traffic services. In order to make the Civic Center more sustainable, I think we should do exactly what they do at the Central States Fair. If you want a great spot, you pay $3 and you get to park right next to the Civic Center. But hey, here's this free lot right over here if you don't. I think it's not going to affect it because people will have a choice. Okay.
Jack, could I just, sure, maybe a quick comment? The 6 minutes, 6 minutes for the three of us, including the marathon runner here,
is
a different 6 minutes than the 6 minutes for our parents. You know, and yep, you know, the unfortunately, to many people for whom the walk would be the most difficult are also the ones who are most price sensitive. Yep.
Well, and that's going to, I think the statement maybe is probably agreed. It may well be necessary, and it will be a lead balloon in terms of popularity.
And the garage is actually the closest thing to the facility now, so I do think that's going to help for those folks who do have that access.
Now, we come into the question next, which is kind of interesting, driven by the need to update and address issues, ADA issues with the Barnett Arena, and the cost. The question is, at what point does that cost make it economically and beneficial to the community to address a significantly expanded operation to the Civic Center? There has to be some
sure
level, and the numbers of $36,000 to upgrade and
$79,000.
Million. Or million, yeah, sorry about that. I'm not used to the age of billionaires, but the $36 million and $79 million are tossed about. But somewhere in there, somebody has to make a decision.
Sure. So the point that I made at the press club, I don't know if any of you were there, is even if we spent a dollar, we would be spending a dollar rather than investing our money for the future. And let's talk about what I mean by that. Because the Civic Center is broken, everything that we do just to bring it up to code isn't going to fix the marketability of the arena. It's not going to allow us to expand the stock show. It won't allow us to book more concerts. It won't allow us to attract the RV show they want to do 3 times a year. So if we want the economic impact that drives the economy, we have to expand it. So even if the plan costs a dollar, which currently my concern is, we have to invest for the future. I know a point was brought up recently that what happens if the base closes? That could be terrible. That could really, really monkey things up a little bit. And as an honorary commander out at the base, I got a program for 2 years, and I don't want to see that happen. But I got to tell you, my goal is to make sure that no matter what happens, we'll be fine. Quote that I gave recently, which got a little scrutiny, is that I want to invest the dollars that we have now to make sure that we're completely sustainable for the future, so that should bad things happen, we're ready. Because the tourists come here and they give us their money.
Yeah, I want to make sure I'm not misunderstanding you. You are saying that you believe if there's any significant cost to bring it up to par, that it is a wasted opportunity if it's not used to improve the facility for future needs as well as just to bring it up for the level it should be at now.
Right. There won't be any return on investment if we just fix the problems. Right. I want a return on investment. I think that's prudent.
Okay. Thank you. Richard?
I want a return on investment, too, of course. I suggest that we've been presented a false choice if it's suggested that the two alternatives are $180 million for an additional arena with the capacity for a full-size football field with 14,000 people at athletic events and 19,000 people for a convention or a speaker. I suggest it's a false choice that is one, and the other is simply fixing the ADA. There's an in-between. There's an in-between. And part of the issue here is that the Civic Center Expansion Committee, when it began this project, did not have a budget. They were working simply from and towards what they saw, what they envisioned as the maximum facility that they could envision in comparison with facilities around here. And you know, the costs are not just construction. The costs are interest. The costs are operating and maintenance. The costs are opportunity costs, what's lost. So I don't think cost wasn't the driving factor in arriving at this proposal. The proposal was arrived at first, and then we were handed the cost.
And so you're not quibbling with the concept that we're going to repair this, that an expansion for envisioned future and profitable use to the community is not out of line. The question is, how much of that?
Correct. Correct.
What I'd like to add, though, is the point that Richard makes is that we're down to two choices. And we're down to two choices because 3 years ago we started this process. And we're down to two choices because every plan from moving it out to Rushmore Crossing to just doing the ADA compliance, all those things were evaluated. And I got to tell you, what I like to think about is the people that we elected, the people that know our principles, that know our values, those are the people that are in office, and they've been the ones vetting this since day one, since the get. And I have a hard time believing that their responsibility to keep us safe and make responsible decisions, all of a sudden they just lost their minds.
We have views on the expansion, and I'm trying to avoid the war.
Sure.
I want more to explain views,
sure.
And I think they're well stated and are comfortable there. The next question is one that has a considerable interest to me. I don't know about the rest of the world, but I had not heard of or was not familiar with a concept of a project manager at risk form of contracting. And consequently, I asked the threshold question, is that concept an appropriate method for arranging the facility?
a CMAR, construction manager at risk approach, is most important and most valid when time is more important than money. And the reason is CMAR, project manager at risk, is basically a design build approach. And when time is of critical essence, it puts everyone in the same room, and it does not require the bidding that is typically done on a city project, certainly of this size. Is it acceptable? The city of Sioux Falls used it for the Sanford Center. A bit different than us, they'd already had about 20 to 25% of their costs incurred in terms of foundation and steel, but they used it. The problem that I have with the project manager at risk, that the proponents suggest that, well, the advantage is it isn't going to go over whatever the stated maximum is, $180 million at this point. I would suggest, however, too, if I am Jim Scull or any other construction company that's doing this, I know just as much as everybody else that I have to account for contingencies, I have to account for inflation, and so I have to pad my budget to protect myself, to protect me from going out, going under with this thing. And secondly, I'd suggest that a construction company then has an incentive to hit the maximum, not to do it for less. If the maximum has been approved, then that's my incentive. I just as well go right up to that maximum. And I give you a contradictory answer that, yes, it is used. It's often used. It's best when it's time is of the essence, but it raises questions about whether we'll get the most competitive deal.
So let's talk about what it prevents. Richard, having went to Harvard and being in Boston and me spending a decade out there, let's talk about what it prevents. The Big Dig went over budget by about 3 times the amount that was forecasted because complex projects get complex. It's just a fact. And what we need to realize is that this protects us. This makes sure that we can budget for exactly what we know it's going to cost, make sure we can in fact afford it, and then we go from there. And that's what we did. And that's what's important about this project, is that it won't go over by a penny, because all that's authorized is $180 million. Anything within that has to be absorbed by the construction manager at risk. So should steel prices go up, it's their problem, it's not our problem. And construction costs are rising. So this is great because we get to know exactly what we're getting ourselves into. Unlike the Horace Mann pool, originally slated at about $4 million, it's now an $8.4 million project. So when we do something like this, we're protected, we know what we're getting ourselves into, and we're getting together with a state-of-the-art builder. Mortenson actually typically comes in ahead of schedule and under budget.
In this line, let me ask a question, and I think it's kind of consistent with a concern raised by Richard, and that is, wouldn't it be, or would it be better if the detailed plans of what were to be built were presented to the group that would handle the construction project, manager at risk kind of a thing, so that the specifics of the design would be already set, and that be used to determine the amount, and at that point the project manager at risk would come into play.
The problem is that it'll take about $10 to $12 million just to get blueprints, and as anybody who can tell you that's in these size projects now, that style of design kind of went out with Y2K, as Donovan pointed out. The modern way that people do now is they use all the technology that we have, 3D modeling, that actually in real time can actually change. So if something changes on the project, it automatically adjusts the cost and everything from there. So really, it's kind of an antiquated model to do the blueprints and then work your way forward.
Richard?
Blueprints are going to have to be prepared anyway, and the Architects Commission is going to be included anyway at 6 or 8 or 10%, whatever it is currently. So the cost of those detailed designs will be incurred nonetheless, because the construction company has to have it to build it.
Have any contracts or agreements been entered into by the city or subcomponent of the city with any third party to date? What contracts, if any, are in existence?
What's already been paid for example, would be the initial concept drawing and then the selection of the construction manager.
I mean towards the actual construction or the building, not the studies and things that went out.
So per competitive South Dakota law, you actually have to bid all those things out. So because the final drawings haven't been done, none of those people have been selected.
Now, I'm assuming the city will not be part of the bidding process, that will be for the project managers. Is that fair? Is that an accurate statement?
The project managers are the ones selecting based upon the competitive bid process.
And they will bid to their subcontractors, but the city will not be part of that. Is that fair?
Yes, that as I understand it, that's fair. However, I take issue, Tony. My understanding is that in November of 2013, Mortenson and Skull were recommended by the Civic Center Board to the City Council as the project managers, and so that a contract has been entered into with them for their role as the construction managers at risk.
Right, but the other third parties, for example, for steel, for concrete, for electrical, for HVAC, none of those things have
been. But so the general contractors, if I may use that term, I think probably better understood by most of us, are already determined.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. The next question comes is an economic one we talked about, and we're talking about whether the current Civic Center breaks even monetarily, that is, at least pays its own way, and is breaking even a significant interest or important to the decision to go forward with the new center, with that center, quote, breaking even. I think it's your run.
Okay. So when I first looked at this project, my biggest concern was making sure that we could actually, in fact, fill this place up. And along that track, Joel Landine pointed out during a meeting, he said, if these things were huge profit generators, then private industry would build them. And if you notice, private industry really doesn't build them. So breaking even is always a target, but you have to realize that this is more about quality of life. I think back to my friends who are starting to move back, or even the reasons why I left. If you have great quality of life and you can compete with a Seattle or compete with a Boston, you can retain the young people in our community. For example, Sam Ellis here, who's launched a business to actually help support other women as they grow theirs. Or Justin Crispin, who's taken a risk with the Man Salon on two occasions and been rewarded with tremendous growth. If we want to keep these people, we have to understand this is a critical component to keeping and being competitive. We have to do this for the future, and I think that's what's important. So the goal is to break even, but that's not the most important part.
Okay. The preliminary question, however, was, does the existing facility pay its own way?
It's subsidized with the BBB, but it doesn't get any other general fund money from the city.
Okay, so it gets right somewhere between upper $2 and $3 million a year right now from the BBB.
Yep.
Is that fair?
And so unlike the pools, however, that take $685,000 a year from the general fund, they actually don't take any money from the city.
Well, the city, I'm sorry, I want to stay out of the
so
debate.
My turn? Yes, the Civic Center runs a deficit. The city's Civic Center runs a deficit of $3 million. The Civic Center's operating budget, round numbers, is $9 million. Okay? $9 million to heat, cool, staff, clean, promote to the extent that Civic Center does, not the CVB, is $9 million. $6 million is the revenue that is earned from rent and concessions. There's a $3 million deficit. That's a one-third that's approximately equal, actually, to what the U.S. government's deficit is, about a third of its budget. Now, that deficit is made up for with a portion, 75% of the bed, booze, and board tax. So when you go out for dinner in Rapid City and have a drink, you pay an extra penny to the city which is part of the BB&B, and if you or have guests that stay overnight, there's an extra penny city sales tax on that. So that is, and state law is very restrictive in how these different sources of money can be used. I would say, Tony's technically correct, of course, that it's that BB&B is not general fund money and could not, for example, go to subsidize the operation of swimming pools. But on the other hand, it's tax money, it's city money, and it's real money. And, you know, where are we going to, you know, it's your money. It's your money. Where are we going to spend it? That would be my response, okay. Jack.
We're down to a last question, and at that point we're going to let these gentlemen address any issue that they choose for about 3 minutes on the questions. But what I did want to say to the people gathered here is we publish questions. There was one question published that comes from a misinterpretation or misreading of the feasibility study which phrased the increase in annual average increase in the sales BBB tax of 7%. That number is correct only if you apply it to the BBB tax, and it accounts for that because of increasing hotel, motel prices, food prices, and the building of new motels and facilities we have here. So in terms of that number, the 7% appears to be an accurate statement of where it is. The city sales tax has never been represented to be at that level, and any impression that came from the published questions that that was the case would be wrong, and I apologize for that. The city average is somewhere around 4% or thereabouts in annual increases, and these gentlemen were kind enough last night, we discussed this, and they don't have an issue with that, and I wanted to clarify that because the 7% kind of hangs out there, and it's kind of a, can be an ugly number and create some misimpressions that might actually affect votes. And the numbers used for the planning are not based upon the 7%, and they're based upon actually about a 3.5% increase, which is below what has been the historical average. Now, having said that, that question's off the list, and I'm going to let Tony make his, you've got about 3 minutes to say, address whatever you wish to.
Okay.
In furtherance of the vision of the expansion you're representing, the
sure.
Blue Plan.
So what I'd like to close on is think back to 1972 when we approved the initial Civic Center. Just imagine the uncertainty at that point in time. They had no idea what money would come in from the tax that they had created to fund this. We have 40 years worth of data actually showing us exactly what it's going to bring in. And better yet, the growth statistics that were talked about, it's grown so substantially that it's allowing us to do more. And let me talk about the year that it went down. It went down in 2009, and it went down only by 3.22%. So it's about a $375,000 decrease. The city operates at about a $1 million surplus every single year. So imagine this. So now we know that we can afford it because we've got 40 years worth of data showing us what's going to happen. And even one of the worst economic downturns, we see what the worst case situation is. Also, too, what the citizens of Rapid City didn't have in 72 was knowing that people would come. Can you imagine in 72 them ever predicting that Elvis was going to christen the arena? That the stock show would contribute $20 million to our economy in just 10 days. And no one would have ever imagined the benefit of having the Lakota Nation Invitational here and bringing these folks into our community so that we have better understanding. No one could have imagined that. And yet 63.8% of the population said yes. And Don Barnett didn't have the luxury of $700,000 in 3 years. He had a handful of long-distance phone calls to the USD School of Business. So we've spent 3 years, we've invested $700,000 in due diligence, and we've done our homework. And I need people to see that at the end of the day, whichever way you vote, just get out and vote. People sacrifice a lot to make sure that we have that right. And the young people here, it makes me so excited to see you guys engaged and gals, because when we get engaged, we make a difference. So 350 votes decided the last special election, so just a couple of votes could make the difference. So whichever way you vote, just show up and vote, because it's important and it matters.
Folks, I've never learned anything from people who agreed with me. And I promise you that even if a discussion did not change my mind, my next time I addressed that same issue, I had a broader perspective than I had before, and mold stuff. So the request that you consider these matters carefully and vote is absolutely critical. Richard?
Well, if that's your standard, Jack, then I disagree with you.
I feel so much wiser now.
The 1972 is a terrific benchmark, and I don't know how many people in this room were in the city of Rapid City, lived here in 1972? Three people in this whole room. You know, and everybody, I hope everybody understands, you know, the flood and the difference it made. In 1992, 20 years after the flood, the city, and I was finance officer at the time, the city had the opportunity to pay off the remaining bonds that were still outstanding that financed the original Civic Center and had been rolled and changed through the years. At that point, Mayor McLaughlin and a group of civic leaders brought the community together and said, what could Rapid City look at the changes that have occurred over the last 20 years? What could happen in the next 20? Hence, the Vision Fund originally was called Vision 2012. Well, we're already in 2015. You know, we're already beyond that. What I think we need to remember is that this $180 million proposal would absorb, it doesn't absorb all of the available vision funds, but it absorbs them to a degree that for the next 5 to 7 years we'd be unable to do any other projects. After that, our ability would be greatly restricted compared to what we have. And the question is, you know, what is the impact on this community? And clearly, we've all said it, and I agree that the importance of the Civic Center is, I believe can be overstated, though it should not be understated either. But the fact is, when we look back at, you know, for those of you who weren't here even in 1992, recognizing the differences in this community from, you know, Storybook Island and Catron Boulevard and Sioux Park and Little League Fields and South Middle School and Roosevelt Ice Arena and the Rapid City Public Library and Meadowood Golf Course and Skyline Drive hiking trails and M Hill and the Doll Center and the impact of all of those in terms of quality of life and importance to this city, I believe, is greater than the impact of a new arena. And therefore, that's why I urge a no vote, so that we can step back and say, all right, what's reasonable, responsible, and realistic in terms of what we can afford in this community, and taking the broad view.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
We just want to say thank you again to Tony and Richard and Jack. We have a small token of appreciation.
Dinner was good enough for me.
That was amazing.
And the donuts.
Thank you, Jack. Yes.
So Jack has a very interesting diet, along with his seven marathons he runs. He consumes an inordinate amount of donuts and tab soda, we've learned. But
they made me pour the tab in the coffee cup, but it is tab.
It is tab in the coffee, yeah. That's yours, Tony.
Thank you so much.
Should we open these now?
Please. And we just want to say thank you. This form actually came because of survey responses from people who have attended over the last couple months. We really appreciate the time that everybody spent.
Very cool.
it reminds us that there are a lot of organizations in this community and people in the community that make this community what it is, including this artwork comes from Susie Capa Art Center and is created by Cookie Anderson. And it's just a nice reminder of the Black Hills and why we choose to live here. So thanks for showing up this morning at 7 a.m. We'll announce the next morning fill-up for April in the upcoming weeks, and hope everybody has a great day. Thank you.